Hi, Jerome here. I'm delighted to be back in this role, leading the conversations for the podcast here at Keele University. And I've got a very different format for you for this episode. I'm not taking our guest for a walk and a talk around our lake on campus. Instead, our guest is joining us via Zoom from overseas, from Gibraltar. You'll understand more about why that is in just a moment. Let me introduce our guest. He's our Professor of Global Healthcare, Workforce and Strategy. He's Professor Ian Cumming, OBE. Welcome to the podcast, Ian.
Thank you, Jerome. It's great to be with you.
Tell us about your surroundings. Just describe where you are.
Well, actually, at the moment, I'm sat in the hospital in Gibraltar, which is one of the most spectacularly situated hospitals that I've ever been in. It has an amazing view looking out over the Straits of Gibraltar, a very clear view of Morocco at the moment, which is some 8 or 9 miles away, looking out over the marinas, huge amounts of shipping traffic coming in and out of the Mediterranean, and the sun's out, which always makes things nicer.
So, Ian, you joined Keele in the spring of 2020, and at the very same time, you took up the role as UK Ambassador for Health for the UK's overseas territories. So, when most of us were filling our time doing fitness classes on Zoom and searching the internet for, I don't know, banana bread recipes, you started coordinating the response to COVID in places such as Gibraltar, the Falklands, Bermuda. I want to know, though, what first went through your mind when that call came in?
So it was the timing just couldn't have been worse, or in some ways couldn't have been better, that I was starting with Keele. And as another part of my role, as you say, I was becoming the UK Ambassador for Healthcare to the Overseas Territories, which basically means that I act as the UK government relationship manager effectively on healthcare with the 13 populated overseas territories. And I knew a little bit about some of the overseas territories, but certainly not a huge amount. And then, of course, by the time I actually came to commence in role, COVID had well and truly hit. So the early stages of my role, first of all, the very first territory I visited was Gibraltar, where I'd been asked to do some work for them, looking at their state of readiness to be able to respond to whatever the pandemic may develop into. And it was really spooky because I remember driving to Heathrow Airport to actually get on a flight to come out to Gibraltar. Arrived in Terminal 5. There was one flight that day leaving from Terminal 5, which was to Gibraltar. And it was, I think there were about 15 people on the plane. It was spooky. It was really, really weird walking through Heathrow with nobody else there at all. I then was in Gibraltar for a couple of weeks, came back to the UK, and I went out to the Turks and Caicos Islands to do a similar piece of work for them in the Caribbean. But for various reasons, I ended up spending not far short of 3 months in Turks and Caicos, partly to do with travel logistics because the islands went into lockdown while I was there, and therefore I became dependent on the RAF to get me home, and partly because we were just providing intensive support to and our group of islands that were very dependent on the United States for access to supplies, provisions, etc. And of course, the United States were in lockdown, and therefore that access route became cut off. So we were having to supply directly through the Royal Navy and other means from the UK. So I stayed there to help kind of facilitate their preparation and establishment for COVID.
Were the challenges the same place by place?
Yes and no is the answer to that. So with many of the overseas territories, there is only one hospital, there is only one healthcare system. So the concept of mutual aid doesn't exist. Whereas in the UK, if somewhere gets overwhelmed, you've got somewhere down the road or help, somewhere you can help to get you out of whatever the difficulty is that you're in. If you're in a UK overseas territory, there is help, but that help may well be in the UK, which is thousands of miles away. So you have got to be much more self-sufficient. You've got to be much more resilient. I think making sure that supply chains, you remember the discussions during COVID about PPE and access to PPE. Well, it was really, really difficult in the UK. Imagine what it's like if you're on a remote island in the middle of nowhere and we're trying to access PPE and get that to them. So yes, many of the issues and challenges are the same, but actually an added layer of complexity because of the lack of immediate help and support and the planning that needs to go into making sure everything's available.
With a long career that you've had in the NHS, you must have had a lot of contacts already that you were able to draw upon.
Yes, I mean, that's been absolutely invaluable. And I have to say that people in the NHS were absolutely fantastic whenever we reached out for help. So both at the time, what was Public Health England, they were just amazing in terms of the help, support and advice they were able to give. But also colleagues I had been working in what was Health Education England, colleagues in Health Education England were also fantastic in terms of the support and advice they were able to offer. But also individual hospitals, for specific advice, individual doctors, even when we needed clinical support and advice, we were able to reach out. But I have to say, the work that the Foreign Office did in the UK was nothing short of magnificent in terms of the support they provided to the overseas territories. Given that this is not an area that the Foreign Office would normally work, they really stepped up to the plate. And everything that I ever wanted and needed for any of the overseas territories, they found a way to deliver.
So are we better prepared now, do you think, for another pandemic?
Is that a UK question or overseas territory question? I think, of course, we are, because having been through it, we really have a very current understanding of what the issues, the problems, the challenges actually are. What we definitely have in the overseas territories is laboratories, for example, that are now equipped to test for a range of diseases. And that would just have been unheard of pre-COVID. One of the early things that we did was deliver with teams on the ground in the overseas territories, the ability to use PCR testing for COVID. Now that's a technique that many of the overseas territories had never heard of, let alone actually routinely used in their laboratories. Well, that's now embedded in almost all of our overseas territories. And of course, PCR techniques aren't just used for COVID, they're used for a range of different conditions. So we're able to start undertaking surveillance for a wide range of different conditions now across the overseas territories. I think resilience in terms of, for example, supply of oxygen. So in a number of our overseas territories, we've put oxygen generation plants in place now, which were to ensure that we had a supply of oxygen because we couldn't rely on ships bringing cylinders of oxygen. So we put the oxygen plants in. Of course, that's now of use beyond COVID. So I'm in Gibraltar, as I said earlier, at the moment, and the oxygen generation plant in Gibraltar is now supplying oxygen to the hospital on a routine basis. So yes, I think we are much, much more resilient, but that doesn't mean we should ever let our guard down. And it doesn't mean that we should ever stop planning and preparing.
Thinking just personally, what would you say was the biggest challenge to you and maybe your biggest achievement?
So I think there's several answers to that. First of all, prior to taking on this post, I didn't understand how different the overseas territories were from each other. Now, obviously, I knew that Gibraltar and the Falklands and Bermuda weren't the same. But if you look at the Caribbean area, for example, where we've got Anguilla and Montserrat and British Virgin Islands, I would have assumed that they were all similar in terms of the challenges facing their healthcare system, because actually they're pretty close together geographically, but there's nothing further from the truth. They each have their own very different, very distinct culture. They each have their own issues, problems and challenges. And to try and approach them with the perspective that they are the overseas territories is fundamentally wrong. They are completely different in terms of the help and support that they need. I think some of the other issues are, I think now that I'm 3 years into the role, I'm just about understanding what the role actually entails. It's been a very sharp learning curve for me. Of course, there's transferable learning from my multiple years as a chief exec and in other roles in the NHS. But actually, the systems are different. The healthcare provision is different. The culture is different. The population is different. In some of the overseas territories, people believe just as strongly in herbal medicine as they do in perhaps traditional Western medicine. And you've got to therefore think about, well, how do we incorporate that in the overall planning, the overall strategy for healthcare service delivery? So I think I've learned a huge amount. In terms of biggest successes or things I'm proud of, I'm really proud and to have played a small part in the vaccination campaigns around the world, and particularly actually if I focus on Gibraltar, where we managed to run a very, very successful campaign in Gibraltar, where we led the world in terms of the percentage of the population that we were able to get vaccinated and the time we were able to deliver that vaccination. Now, I was a small cog in the machine that delivered that, but actually being able to see a level of protection rolled out to the population at a time when large numbers of people, particularly in the nursing residential care sector, were dying, was really remarkable, because you just knew that the difference that was being made by the healthcare system was saving lives in real time.
The COVID crisis, if we can call it that, is over really now. But what would you say is on the horizon? What do you feel is the biggest threat to human health on the globe at the moment?
That's a very interesting question. So I think there's two component parts to that. The first of those is the enormous challenge that we're facing around the world with non-communicable diseases, so diabetes, heart disease, etc. And again, in the overseas territories, trying to shift the agenda away from sickness to health is critically important. So I often say that I've spent my career working for the National Sickness Service rather than National Health Service, because that's actually what it feels like, that we diagnose and treat. We have got to move all our healthcare systems upstream, and we've got to start looking at predicting and preventing rather than simply diagnosing and treating. And if you look at the incidence in some of the overseas territories, for example, of type 2 diabetes, which is significantly linked to lifestyle factors, lack of exercise, poor diet, obesity, it's just spiraling. And the consequences of somebody having type 2 diabetes in terms of the impact that then has on eyesight, on circulation, on cardiovascular disease generally is absolutely enormous. And although we're still seeing people living for longer, we're starting to see people living for longer, but with more ill health. So that first big challenge is getting into young people and then really pushing that health promotion exercise message, in particular a focus on exercise. Exercise is a wonder drug, and for many of us, we haven't actually realized that yet. The impact that exercise has on mental health and physical health is just absolutely enormous. So that probably is the first area. The second area, which is worrying, I think, to all of us, is the impact of bacteria, viruses on us when antibiotics don't work as they used to. So the antimicrobial resistance movement is something that is really, really challenging for some bacteria. Their ability to mutate is outstripping the ability for antibiotics to keep up with them. And although there is now massive investment going into developing new antibiotics, I think antibiotic resistant bacteria are a real threat to all of us around the world.
So are these two issues going to be your main focus in your work at Kiel, with Kiel Deal Health and the Institute for Global Health?
Yes. So what I'm trying to do is to make connections between the various strands of work that I actually do. So wearing my overseas territories ambassador hat, the things that I'm looking at now are workforce. So how do we recruit, retain and retrain the workforce now? That's an issue for the UK, but that's very much an issue for the overseas territories as well. And in particular with the overseas territories, how do we make sure that people keep up to speed with what's going on in healthcare? Very, very fast moving environment. So how do we make sure that we deliver CPD and other appropriate activity? Focusing on the quality of care that's being delivered, which is obviously inextricably linked to the workforce, is another key strand of work that I'm keen to pursue. And then looking at pre-hospital and out-of-hospital care is also the third area that's an important aspect. How do we make sure that before we get somebody to a hospital, that they've been given the necessary life-saving interventions? And there's a lot of learning here, I think, we could take from the UK into some of the overseas territories. And then I suppose finally, putting all that lot together as an overarching grouping is what is the medium and long-term strategy for our healthcare systems? We are aging as a population around the world. We are living with more ill health, as I've already said. And we are starting to see real challenges on the affordability and sustainability of our current model of healthcare. So what does that actually mean for the future? What role does artificial intelligence have to play in the delivery of healthcare? What does the model of healthcare delivery actually look like, both in the UK and the overseas territories? And that's the area I'm particularly interested in at the moment.
Tell us something about the young Ian. What are your earliest memories?
Oh, that's a really interesting question. So I was born into very much a healthcare family. My dad was a GP. My mum was a nurse and then a health visitor. And the youngest of four, we used to live above the surgery. And that was quite an interesting experience, because obviously we weren't supposed to play in the surgery, but of course, with four children, we did. I do distinctly remember at school, whenever 50ml syringes appeared as water pistols, they knew exactly who to blame. But we lived above the surgery for a number of years, then moved out into a house elsewhere. All the family, apart from my next brother up, have ended up working in healthcare in one form or another. And indeed, if I look at the next generation, most of our kids, most of my nephews and nieces all work in healthcare as well. So we're very much a healthcare family. We have often joked and said that actually, if you look at our extended family, we have got more or less one of everything to work in the healthcare system. So I think health has been very much in our blood from an early age. I didn't really know what I wanted to do as I was going through school, if I'm honest. I knew I wanted to work in healthcare, but I didn't nearly know what. Did I want to go into medicine? Did I want to go into the sciences? Did I want to consider one of the allied health professions? And actually, I ended up kind of accidentally just really following what my eldest brother has done as a routine. And then, much as I enjoyed that role, I used to work in research into blood coagulation disorders in the Haemophilia Centre in Manchester. I didn't see myself doing that for the next 30, 40 years. So I took a training programme opportunity that existed to move clinicians from healthcare delivery into management leadership roles. I took that as a regional training programme in the Northwest, and then kind of moved through a series of different jobs through into chief executive of my first trust in Lancaster. And then spent the next 25 years as chief execs in different roles in the NHS before moving into this exciting new portfolio role I've got.
How did the Kiel opportunity come about?
So I've known people at Kiel for a number of years. One of the jobs that I was in from 2009 to 2012 was as the chief exec of the NHS in the West Midlands. And obviously in that role, Kiel was a significant provider of education and training for the healthcare workforce. And obviously the Kiel Medical School, I'd known from years before when I was in the Northwest, I'd helped set up the medical school at Lancaster University. And Kiel was very much a role model that we looked towards in Lancaster when we were looking at developing our own medical school there. And then when I'd had a number of conversations about what I was looking to do next, I'd always promised myself that I wouldn't do more than 25 years as a chief exec, because I wanted to do something different. One of the advantages I had, or disadvantages in some ways, was I got my first chief exec job very young, which meant I didn't want to stay in it for the rest of my career. So I was quite clear that I wanted to move into an opportunity. I've been doing quite a lot of work with Lancaster University, and then I was invited to take on an honorary position at Kiel University some little time ago. And then with the establishment of the Institute for Global Health and the work that I was doing, I was also heading up something called NHS Global when I was in my previous role as well. I was asked if I would be interested in joining Kiel on a part-time basis in the role that I took on. I have to say it's been absolutely fantastic to work with some really motivated, really clever, really dynamic people, and to bring a couple of new programs to Kiel. So we've established an MSc in Global Health Leadership that I'm involved in. We have established, in conjunction with the universities of Pavia, Hanover, and Ljubljana, an MSc in Artificial Intelligence in Healthcare. And we're starting to look at what more relationships and links we can actually build across the overseas territories. So that for me is really, really exciting, because it allows me to bring together the different roles that I undertake.
I'm fascinated by artificial intelligence and its impact, and currently in the news all of the time, of course, with things like ChatGPT and generative AI for imagery. I've spent my career as a photographer, so the way AI is impacting photography and design is totally fascinating. How do you think AI is going to impact medicine and health?
Oh, so the impact is going to be absolutely enormous, but the transition towards using more AI is going to be really challenging and really difficult, because some jobs may just disappear. Other jobs will change beyond all recognition. And I think what we have to keep in the back of our minds is that healthcare is basically a person-to-person interaction at the moment. And although in not that far in the future, we can see all diagnoses being undertaken by AI in one form or another, which then does cause you to reflect on what does the role of a doctor become in the future, et cetera, et cetera. So we can see that coming. But how we manage that, particularly if you take histopathology to start with, for example, then looking down the microscope at colour and pattern recognition, we already have machines that are better at that than the human eye. We know that machines are already better at diagnosing breast cancer on mammograms than the human eye. We already know that equipment exists that can do almost everything that a high street optometrist can actually do. But what does it mean for these roles? So if you take radiologists, for example, well, I actually think we are always going to need radiologists, because they don't just sit in a darkened room reporting x-rays, but it is quite a significant percentage of their role, and it's a significant percentage of their training. So as we get to the stage where machines are better, which we are now, how do we change training pathways? But how do we also think through some of the really key governance issues around it? So what happens if our AI makes a mistake? You know, who's to blame?
Responsible. Yeah.
Is it the programmer? Is it the doctor that's relied on that AI to give a diagnosis to a patient? And I think there's many, many ethical issues, governance issues to be worked through with AI, but it's here now. So, you know, if I stay with mammograms for a minute, I was reading something recently that suggested that the latest software for reporting mammograms is 10% more accurate than the human eye, which to me would suggest that we're now at that tipping point where it may be medico-legally negligent to not use AI to report a mammogram. So we are really at that tipping point, but the impact on the workforce is just absolutely immense. And we've got to start thinking about what that means and how it works. But the most important part that I think we really have to remember, when people talk about hospital at home and using the Internet of Things to connect up somebody's bedroom or somebody's house so they don't actually need admission to hospital, whatever, there's some real positives associated with that, but there are some negatives. And quite often for patients, one of the most important parts of healthcare is somebody actually having the time to sit and hold the hand or talk to them when they're upset, when they're distressed, when they're worried. And if we lose that by simply passing everything to a machine, I think we've got a real problem. So it's that care, that compassion that healthcare delivers as well. And I'm really keen that as we bring in AI and the technical side of diagnosis and treatment, we don't lose that kindness, that care, that compassion that our healthcare workforce deliver.
You've spent your whole career looking at the health of all individuals on the globe. What do you do to look after your own health?
a really interesting question. Very relevant, actually, to COVID for myself. So I mentioned that I was in Turks and Caicos for quite some period of time. I was actually living in the same accommodation as 30 Royal Marines, who had also been posted out to Turks and Caicos. Now, they kept inviting me to participate in their physical training and to go out for a run with them. Obviously, I declined purely because I didn't want to show them up. But I did. It did start me thinking that I had put on a bit of weight, as quite often people do over the years. And I realized that I was nowhere near as fit as I used to be. And actually, my own kind of promise to myself during COVID was that I would get fit again and I would lose some weight. And COVID for me was actually a really good opportunity to do that, because as you said yourself, when everyone else stopped traveling, I was traveling around the world. And if there's one thing that you can do when you're traveling around the world, is you can go for a run. And although, you know, many things were closed down, actually, you, as long as you kept within curfew hours, you could still go out. So I started running, which is something that I've not done for a long time. And although I'm not quite as good as I used to be, I do try and go out for a run two or three times a week, or go to the gym and use the treadmill two or three times a week. But my my passions are skiing. I'm a absolutely passionate skier. And if I could, I would spend every single day somewhere on a mountain. But so I really enjoy skiing. That's being in the mountains, walking in the mountains as well in summer. That's my real number one passion. But I'm trying to practice what I preach a bit at the moment and keep weight off and keep fit.
When are we going to see you on campus? Have you got any visits planned?
Yes. So I was on campus a few weeks ago, actually. We had the UK leg of our MSc in Global Healthcare Management. They were based on campus for a week. It's an predominantly online program, but they do a week study trip to Italy, a week in the UK, a week in India, and a week in Thailand, Myanmar, studying different healthcare systems, comparing and contrasting, looking at basically in search of a perfect healthcare system. And we had them on Keele campus for a week. So I was there a few weeks ago. What I try and do is in between each of my overseas territories visits, I try and come back onto campus to touch base with people, to look at what we can take forward. Been having some really positive meetings around artificial intelligence, actually, on across different departments and faculties, to look at how we can take that together and where we position Keele in that area. So yeah, I'll be back I'm back from Gibraltar today, actually. And then I'm off to St. Helena. So I'm only back for a few days and then off to St. Helena, which is a fascinating place. And as soon as I'm back for there, I'll be back on campus.
Do you explore these places a lot when you're traveling around? Do you get time to do that?
When I can, I think a lot of people have this mental picture of me sitting on a beach somewhere when I'm in the Caribbean. But as I pointed out recently, so I go to Turks and Caicos quite a lot. Turks and Caicos is gorgeous, but Turks and Caicos also has a significant problem with undocumented immigrants and violent crime. So unfortunately, when I'm there, I tend not to be sat on the beach in the nice part of Turks and Caicos. I tend to be looking at how we stop people bleeding out at the side of the road who've been shot or stabbed. So yes, I do. And certainly I try, when I'm away, I don't typically work a 5-day week. I usually work a 6-day week because of the amount of time I'm there for. But I do try and get a day a week to do something, to either go diving or go walking or occasionally just sit and chill and relax a little bit. But yeah, it's a real privilege to have the combination of jobs that I do have. It's really interesting. It's really stimulating. And trying to balance that, the various different components, is one of the biggest challenges I have, I think.
I totally love my role leading these conversations for the podcast. I get to meet people like yourself. Totally fascinating, your subject material, your career. Ian, thank you so much for your time this morning.
Thank you very much indeed. It's been a great privilege.